Good morning. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, Lila Silverstein on behalf of Sloan Stanley. This case is obviously a very sad case from multiple perspectives. In terms of the legal issues, the first issue was addressed by our state Supreme Court after I filed the opening brief in this case, so I won't discuss that issue today, even though we're continuing to challenge the decision in Trayam. The second issue is that even under the reasonable person standard for true threats, the state presented insufficient evidence to support the convictions on count 6 and count 9. The statements at issue in those counts were very similar to the statements in the Kahonen case. They expressed a passive desire to harm the recipients, but not an intention to do so. Also, the surrounding context indicates that these messages were cries for help and not true threats. In fact, the overarching context for all of these messages was that of a despondent young man who was tormented by his vivid memories of a particular evening, and he wanted the people he thought were with him that night to explain to him what really happened. And he believed that if they did this, then he would be free of his mental anguish. So, for instance...
How can the statement, I want to send you back to hell, in one count be adequate evidence, and I want to send you to hell in another count not be adequate?
Well, so for those two, first of all, the statements themselves are slightly different, but also the surrounding context is quite different, both in terms of the other sentences within the messages at issue and in terms of the surrounding messages. But of course, if this court, pursuant to its required independent review, determines that there is also insufficient evidence as to count 5, then obviously we would not object. My position is simply that at a minimum, reversal is required as to count 6 and count 9. In terms of count 9, the surrounding messages say things like, "I can't take anymore, please Liz, please help me," and "Why won't you people just care, allow me a chance to have a life, I'm so down right now," etc., etc. So particularly for count 9, so many of these messages were cries for help. Exhibit 5 is the one that relates to count 9. That's where all of the messages to that person are contained. And that exhibit is filled with not only cries for help, but also sort of daily diary entries where Mr. Stanley is discussing his life, his work, his apartment, his childhood, even his garden. And in fact, both of these women testified that Mr. Stanley seemed at times to be using his messages to them as a daily diary or a type of journaling. And so that obviously cuts against a finding of a true threat.
I want to make sure you have time to talk about the constitutional challenges.
Sure, if you'd like to talk about that.
I want to make sure I understand you're making a facial challenge.
On the third issue, yes, Your Honor, yes. And so subsection A, for example, has many words in it that are both overbroad and vague. For instance, it prohibits use of indecent language, which is overbroad and vague. And the first part, the intent portion of the statute, is also overbroad and vague because mere intent to embarrass or harass is sufficient to criminalize speech. And the harm has to be much greater than that if you want to criminalize speech. It has to be a serious harm. So
in our analysis, we pay no attention to the specific charge here in the to convict instruction that these were threats to kill, and we pay no attention to the fact that none of these communications were in a public forum. They were private emails or private messaging.
Certainly when it gets to the harmless error analysis, you would pay attention to the specific facts of this case. But Mr. Stanley, of course, has standing to challenge the statute on its face because this is a First Amendment issue. And so as to the facial challenge, you do look at subsection A, even though that was not part of the instruction in this case. What was part of the instruction in this case, though, were the words embarrass and harass. And again, those terms, I would submit, are overbroad and vague. So, for instance, if the jury found that Mr. Stanley was guilty because he kept because he intended to harass them by bothering them and bothering them and bothering them until they would speak to him, then that would be insufficient under the First Amendment, and that's why I would submit that it's not harmless as to him.
I guess one way to read Alphonse talking about the telephone harassment statute with very similar language, almost identical language, seems to suggest the big difference on overbreadth is the intent element narrows the arguable overbreadth of the reach of the statute and talks about all of those descriptors establishing that this is conduct implicating speech, not pure speech. Why wouldn't this be, if intent to intimidate is conduct, not speech, why isn't intent to harass?
I guess I disagree that intent to intimidate is not conduct. I mean, there is, so subsection B of both statutes, it could be argued, gets at conduct because it's, for instance, that's the one that gets at repeated hang-up calls where you don't even have to say anything.
Right.
But subsections A and C are definitely content-based restrictions on speech. You know, you can't obviously like threaten to kill someone. That's based on the content of the speech. And then you can't use indecent language. That's based on the content of the speech. And uttering, say, indecent words with the intent to embarrass, that intent does not narrow the scope enough to bring it outside the protection of the First Amendment, because embarrassment is not enough of a harm to do that. And it's also vague because it's sort of this vague psychic harm. What does embarrass really mean? If you narrow the term enough to avoid the overbreadth problem, then it's no longer the common definition of embarrass. And I think that's what the Supreme Court was getting at in Williams when it struck down the section of a different statute that criminalized uttering certain statements with the intent to harm a person's mental health. The state had argued that the intent element rendered it constitutional, but the Supreme Court said, well, but intent to do what? It's the what that is vague and overbroad, and therefore the statute is unconstitutional.
And one of your arguments is distinguishing Alexander, the telephone harassment, is that it does not deal with the public forum. It's a private forum. But when you read the details of Alexander, the focus seems to me to shift toward, is this invasive?
Right.
It's invasive in the home, right to privacy.
Right.
In the contemporary world, what could be more invasive than a communication that goes to personal devices people have with them 24 hours a day?
Almost? Well, that's a good point, because back in the days of Alexander, and I'll use whatever time I need of my rebuttal to answer this question if I could, in the days of Alexander, that was back in the days of telephones, I think without even caller ID, right? This was 1976. And so you had to answer the phone when it was ringing if you didn't want to miss calls from people you wanted to talk to. And so when people would call and call and call and call and call to harass you, there was no way to avoid it. But with modern technology, you certainly can avoid communications from anyone you want. You can block them. In fact, one of the women at issue in this case had no idea Mr. Stanley had been messaging her for 4 years because they weren't Facebook friends, so the messages went somewhere else. The other two did block him for a couple of years. And so the technology is very different, and it's because of the different technology that Alexander does not apply here. Thank you.
Stop 2 minutes.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the Court, Amy Meckling, I'm Deputy Prosecutor for King County, appearing for the state. The cyberstalking statute is a constitutionally valid means of protecting individuals from harassing and abusive electronic communication.
It goes to a public forum and sweeps up communications in a public forum.
And, Your Honor, I would disagree that the forum analysis has any relevance to this type of statute. City of Seattle versus Huff, the old telephone harassment case that talks about the difference between the forums and what level of scrutiny you apply depending, that is an improper analysis of United States Supreme Court authority. The forum analysis has no applicability except when you're talking about government-owned property. So we've gotten back on track. If you look at State versus Lorraine, the Washington Supreme Court has gotten back on track with the proper analysis. And the forum analysis doesn't play a role when you're talking about non-government-owned property like here. So the question that you're asking yourselves when you're talking about an overbreadth analysis is, does the regulation sweep in a substantial amount of protected speech? That's the question. And it can subsume some protected speech so long as it serves a compelling state interest and it's narrowly tailored to do that. So in this particular case, we're talking about electronic communication. The court in Lorang has already determined, the Washington Supreme Court, that preventing telephone harassment is a compelling state interest. So today, when you have this pervasive electronic communication that we live with, it's omnipresent in our lives, the state's interest in protecting individuals from being harassed and abused through that forum is, I would argue, even more compelling than the telephone harassment was in the early 80s and so forth.
What about the response that you can, with modern technology, I can block somebody from messaging me. I can block emails, people on spam lists, so I never see this.
Well, and then there's many ways around that. As the defendant himself demonstrated in this case, he opened a new identity on Facebook and started messaging them with a different name. It's not difficult to defeat those things and contact someone. There are so many different forms of electronic communication and ways to reach people that it's not difficult to circumvent those. We, like Your Honor said, we have these devices with us sort of constantly today. There's many different forms, you know, your text messaging, email, instant messaging, Facebook, there's, you know, everything. It's not difficult to harass and abuse someone if you choose to do that. And simply blocking them is not sufficient. It didn't work for these women here. One of the women didn't realize what was going on, but she wasn't the primary target of his abuse. Now, I wanted to talk about
One more question. Sure. If you shift to a hypothetical and some politician is taking a controversial position and someone is trying to hold them to account by lots of public social media posts, endless posts, that still embarrasses someone and you can be charged with a crime for that?
Well, you can't be charged with a crime if your conduct, just because your conduct embarrasses someone. You have to have the intent to embarrass someone, and you have to do a specific type of electronic communication with that intent in mind. Now, the appellant talks about embarrass and whether that's too vague and we don't know what that means. I think that the common definition of embarrass is to make someone self-conscious and ashamed. Now, the question that you have to decide is whether intending to make someone self-conscious and ashamed and therefore sending out some sort of indecent, lewd text or whatnot, email or post about someone with that intent, you have to decide whether that is the type of compelling state interest that we should protect that enough that we would infringe on some protected speech. That's the question that you have to answer. That's not an easy question. I'm not sure I really even know the answer to that question. I was reading an article yesterday in The Atlantic from a couple of years ago where a woman had been on a date with a man twice and told him she no longer was interested in dating him and cut it off. And the very next day she received a video from him, extremely indecent, lewd, explicit video of him. And she didn't know what it was when she opened it, and she had to see that. You know, that certainly caused her embarrassment. Whether it was harassing, if it only happened one time, maybe not. Did he intend to intimidate or torment her? Probably couldn't prove that. So we have to decide as a society whether or not we want, with the way that electronic communication is and how we have a very difficult time shielding ourselves from it, whether that sort of conduct is what we want to accept as appropriate. So that's what you have to decide. It's not an easy decision. But what I can tell you is that you don't have to find the statute facially invalid because you think the word embarrass is overbroad. If you think that the intent to embarrass someone is not sufficient to protect the right of free speech, then you sever out that language from the statute. You strike it out. And if you can do that and the statute still serves its proper legislative function, then that's acceptable. And clearly the statute serves many purposes beyond protecting someone from embarrassment.
What's the strongest case you have that supports that severance analysis?
State versus Williams specifically says that. I'll read the language to you. An act of the legislature is not unconstitutional in its entirety because one or more of its provisions is unconstitutional. Unless the invalid provisions are unseverable, they're not here. There's a severability clause in the statute. Or unless the elimination of the invalid part would render the remainder of the act incapable of accomplishing the legislative purposes. That's State versus Williams. So clearly, to sever out the word embarrass would still serve a legitimate goal of protecting people from harassment and abuse through electronic communication. This case is a primary example of that. Yes, the jury was told that intent to embarrass was sufficient. It also, they were told that harass, intimidate, and torment was sufficient. There is no question that if you had not given the word embarrass to the jury, they would have still convicted Mr. Stanley. His intent was not to embarrass these women. His intent, as he told the police, was to scare them, increase their stress level, and make them respond to him by threatening to kill them in graphic and disturbing ways for a course of years. They were too scared to even get a restraining order against him because they thought that that would provoke him even further. This was not a man that they knew. This was essentially a virtual stranger to them. They had met him in a bar. He was an acquaintance that they had seen in a bar that they frequented. He felt much more attached to them than they felt for him. And to have essentially a virtual stranger harass you for years, make you change your email, make you shut down your social media accounts, you've gone to the police, you've decided not to get an order because you don't want to exacerbate the situation. There couldn't be anything more harassing, intimidating, or tormenting than that. And to speak to the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence very quickly with respect to the two counts, context is important. Context is vital. And especially with respect to the one victim, Mr. Stanley concedes that he'd threatened to kill her on other occasions, and those counts are properly supported. So here you have a woman who doesn't really know this man. He's clearly unstable. And he may be talking about how he's asking for help and, you know, can you please help me, and talking about other things as well. That just makes it even more frightening. If you have someone you think is unstable threatening you, you're more likely to believe he's actually going to come through with his threats and kill you. So when he tells her, I want to strangle the life out of you, is there any difference between I'm going to strangle the life out of you after he's already threatened to kill you before, and I want to strangle the life out of you? Does that qualifier want versus going to make a real difference in your perception that that is a threat to kill? Of course not. And as Your Honor pointed out with respect to the other victim, telling someone I'm going to send you to hell after threatening them in other ways certainly would be perceived as a threat to kill. And there's sufficient evidence of that. The burden is on the defendant to prove that no rational juror could find that that was sufficient to prove a threat to kill. So unless the court has any further questions, I would ask the court to find that the statute is a proper exercise of the legislative authority to meet a substantial and compelling state goal. If the word indecent or embarrass is, if you feel that that incorporates too much protected speech, then you can sever that out. That doesn't affect Mr. Stanley's conviction. It doesn't affect the facial validity of the statute.
Thank you.
So the state says that what you have to decide and what we have to do as a society is decide what we think is appropriate. That is not the standard for the First Amendment, clearly, right? There's plenty of inappropriate tweets and everything else, both political and otherwise, that we as a society might not think are appropriate. Nevertheless, they are protected by the First Amendment because of the precious right to freedom of speech.
Does the severance work?
Well, so as to severability, it's not just the word embarrass that would have to be severed. In our opinion, it's the words embarrass and harass and most, if not all, of subsection A. So perhaps this court should sever it, but if you sever all of that, you're getting pretty close to rewriting the statute, which is, of course, not the role of the court.
So, in your view, then, I mean, the what happened in this case is simply the price that the society has to pay to make sure that people who are really not, who are just kind of vigorously participating in political speech, let's say, don't feel prevented from doing so.
Well,
and I guess that my question would be, if these cases come up and context is very important, is that not enough to protect the right of free speech where it actually belongs? Because this kind of conduct is very, very disturbing and very, very much experiences harm by the people who experience it.
That's true. And so when, you know, the state does have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the instruction was harmless, that included embarrass and harass, I don't think they have proved that. But if they have proved that, then his convictions would stand. Does that get at your answer to question?
In a way, yes.
Okay. And also, it's important to remember on the second issue, the stricter standard of review that applies in First Amendment cases. Thank you.
Thank you both. Next up is Sinn Scheimer versus Krueger.